All right. If you still have your outline, we have, as we are studying on the assembly, we have discussed why, the purpose of the assembly, and now we are in the process of talking about when, I'm sorry, about where, and we will get started on when today. Where we had left off, if you remember, we had talked about how we have examples in the New Testament that the church assembled in Christians' homes. That's the where we see the biggest example, that most of the congregation congregations met in Christians' homes, but that wasn't exclusively where Christians met. We know that the first after the day of Pentecost, when the church was first established, the church met in Solomon's porch, a portion of the temple. We do know that Paul, it appears as though Paul rented a building, looks like a school building, and used that to teach daily, which then we can make some assumptions on that, that he that the Christians also came together on the first day of the week there as well. We talked a little bit about why we meet in a building instead of a home now, and it led us to the question of, can the church own a building? And it's a very interesting question. We know we have examples of the church assembling in buildings other than members' homes. So we know that we can meet in a building. But now the question becomes, can we own a building? And church ownership of property is something that did not happen in the first century, or at least when the church first started. Because you remember, the church in Jerusalem, what happened? What was, as it relates to property, what are we told in Acts chapter 4? What did the church do?
They sold property.
Yeah.
To help those that were coming from long distances.
That's right. In Acts chapter 4, the church was all in one. And the church didn't have any need of property. The church needed money to take care of the people who were located in Jerusalem that wasn't their home. And so in Acts chapter 4, beginning in verse 34, it says, "Nor was there anyone among them who lacked, for all who were possessors of land or houses sold them and brought the proceeds of the things that were sold and laid them at the apostles' feet. Then they distributed to each as anyone had needed." So, now, this alone just tells us one little picture of the church in Jerusalem. It doesn't prohibit the church from owning property or owning a building, because these are sort of different circumstances, aren't they? The church was all together in one place. The church didn't need to have a building. They met at Solomon's temple. There was no need for them. If Barnabas, which is what the rest of the chapter talks about, if Barnabas came and said, "Hey, I have this land in Cyprus, and I'm going to donate it to the church." Well, the church wasn't in Cyprus at the time. What would it have done with that property? What was needed was money to take care of the needs of the saints. So it made sense that they sold possessions.
But this was individuals.
And that's right.
It's selling their own.
That's right. It is individuals. That's really the only passage that we have any connection. And it's the only reason why I'm bringing it up. It's the only passage where we have any connection between property ownership and the church, and it really isn't about the church collectively, it's about members of the church. But I think that we can make some natural conclusions. In Hebrews, the 10th chapter, the 25th verse, we are commanded to assemble. And this command to assemble also, I think, authorizes a place to assemble, doesn't it? You know, if you're called to assemble there, you must have a gathering place. Now, this is the natural conclusion of that. And so, you know, when we compare this to our study just compare it to this thought. In 2 Timothy 2:15, we're told what? What are we told in 2 Timothy 2:15?
Study
to show yourself approved, and it continues on. Well, what's necessary for you to study? You've got to have the scriptures, right? You have to have the Bible. Now, you might not have to have an individual copy of the Bible, but you have to have access to the Bible. So we're never commanded to have a Bible, but the inference, the natural conclusion is that if I'm going to study, then I must have a Bible to study from. And so the natural conclusion of assembling is that you must have a place to assemble. Now, it could be a home, or it could be a building. And really, when we talk about can a church own a building, those who object to churches owning a building, it's not really the issue of ownership, it really is an issue of how the church finances are used. And the specific question is, can collection funds be used on a building or on items in the building? And the most often thing that comes up is the issue of whether or not there should be a kitchen, whether or not there should be a gymnasium, those sorts of things. Now, I don't want to leave this topic undone, but I do want to say that we're not going to address it right now. Because church finances are something that we will hopefully address when we get to the end of the class. But I will say that if it's sort of a tangent, and so if we get short on time, that might be something that gets pared out. But those who object to owning a building primarily object to it on the issue of church finances. I think it's a matter of expediency. I'm curious, that's really all the comments I had on it. Does anyone else have any thoughts on it?
Are you going to talk about the example of the children of Israel and how they paid for the tabernacle or the temple and all of the things that went in? Where did all that money come from? It came from them.
Yeah, it did come from them.
That's an example that God set for his people where they were to worship. And granted, a lot of things have changed, but we have nothing.
Yeah. The only thing I'm thinking about that, I don't know the passage on this. I'm thinking that the tabernacle that was in the temple was not built using like the tithe funds. I thought it was a separate donation. But for sure,
they had a treasury.
Yeah.
And they used that treasury for it. Well, the upkeep, the support of the priests, they lived out of that, and I would suppose the upkeep of the temple or the tabernacle.
I think that's a good point. I hadn't really thought of it like that.
The priest's food and all of their sustenance came from what the people raised, and you know that's the same as money.
Yeah.
That was barter.
Well, yeah, that's...
The individual members of the church not only... I think built the buildings, they sustained the leaders of the church, like we sustain the evangelists or those who preach.
Well, I think that's a great point.
That's a little bit different thing, but that was God's dwelling place, the tabernacle.
Yeah.
The most holy place.
Yeah.
Today he dwells in
the place. Yeah, there are differences for sure. And because, you know, not everything translates over exactly the same. And we're going to come up that when we talk about when should we assemble, because then we have this whole issue of the Sabbath day and the Lord's day. All right, so I think it's reasonable for us to say that the congregation can have a meeting house. Now the question really is, should we meet in a building or a home? Well, we have clear examples of meeting in homes. Whether we should meet in a building or not is just really one of those weird, I don't know, is it even worth discussing? I do want to make some comments about it, though. By virtue of having a building, we start using terminology that the Bible doesn't use. And as a result of that, it can be very confusing. And specifically what I'm thinking about is church building, right? And it's just one of those things that I think all of us understand what we mean when we say that we're talking about this place where we assemble. But this place where we assemble is not the church. And it can be confusing because we do find that some people look at the buildings themselves and translate that into the temple, don't they? You know, this building is not a temple. And it's pretty amazing how... religious people get when they enter a church building. you know, or enter an assembly place, that there is something special about this place. And it is special in the sense that the church assembles here, but it's no different than any other place that we meet. We know of congregations that meet in schoolhouses. There are congregations that for time periods have met in people's homes. And so is there something special beyond the fact that that's where the church meets? Not really. The building itself should facilitate the needs of the congregation. And so, what's the purpose of the assembly? Edification, encouragement, the Lord's table. So our building ought to be able to do that. But I think we have to be really careful of not making our building sacred. And Duane, you're just itching.
Just remind me, this was years ago when I was a young man. We helped start a congregation in Mill Valley, California. And we met in a hall. It was like a VFW hall.
Uh-huh.
And on Saturday nights, they had their bingo and their whatever. And when you went in there, you were breathing cigarette smoke.
Oh.
And it really reeked.
You know what? We're going to talk.
You know what? We worshiped. It didn't bother at all.
Yeah. I want you to hold that thought, because I'm going to ask another question that is very interesting. I think we have to be really careful not to make our meeting places comparable to the temple. The temple was holy. Our building is not holy. We are holy. We're now the temple of God. And sometimes in the religious world, the idea that the building, the meeting place, is sacred is very easy to see. You know, what do we often hear meeting places called in the religious world at large that would give the idea that they're sacred?
Sanctuaries.
Yeah, that's the one word I've got written down. This is not a sanctuary in the sense that the Bible uses it. It is a place that we assemble. We don't consecrate our building. Some places do that. The temple of the Old Testament, the most holy and holy places, those were sanctuaries. They were consecrated. And yet we are the temple of God now. And in Acts, the 17th chapter, somebody turn to this. We're talking about this issue of, is the building sacred? Someone read Acts 17:24. I think this is probably the clearest passage to tell us our buildings aren't sacred.
God, who made the world and everything in it, since He is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands.
All right, now He used to, but no longer does He dwell in temples made with hands. Where does
Your use of meeting house.
Yeah.
That's kind of my favorite term.
Yeah.
I put pictures, on my Facebook about historical, and thought about that. Church buildings? No, meeting houses.
Now, I mean, there's nothing. I think meeting house is the best word, but I'm going to probably, because of habit, continue to say church building. And that isn't inherently wrong, because what does church mean? What is that?
Assembly.
Assembly, right? So it's the assembly's building. Well, that makes sense.
I think the main thing was, maybe you know, said in Hebrews 10:25. There must be a commonly designated meeting place.
That's right. There has to be a place that you're called together to. Mike?
I just have a question I want to throw out here. You don't really have to answer it, but it's something I think we ought to consider. If the true church is not to have an earthly building that is sacred, then certainly no denomination's building is sacred. So can a Christian righteously pay money to go ooh and ah some fantastic building that the Catholic Church or the Baptist Church or whatever congregate group has built, and go support that by just going to look at it? And, you know, I'm certainly not going to, but, you know, that's just a question I think that, one of the questions I think each person as an individual member should consider. It's not just, you know, if you go to these places and you, certainly if you pay money, you know, so many places don't charge money, you know, going to, and supporting that is one, you know.
I think it's probably real similar to the issue of meats offered to idols. There were We get the idea there were two big objections to eating meats offered to idols. One is the fact that it was offered to an idol. And the second is, well, I'm buying the sale of that meat helped supplement the expense of their religious worships. And I think those are definitely things to look at.
It's like it's something yeah.
Well, in fairness, I'm going to ask some questions I don't want answers to, so I'm not going to answer Mike's question because I don't want you to answer these next questions. They're sort of rhetorical for you to think about. Yeah.
But in the same light, though, they weren't condemned for buying that meat.
No, but...
They're only condemned if they offended somebody.
That's right. There was this issue of what is the right thing within your conscience? If your conscience said, you could not... you could not buy that meat because it's offered to idols, you could not consume it, and you did, then certainly you would be, you'd be sinning to do that.
I think it's a matter of the heart.
Yeah.
It depends on why you went in there to look at that.
For
Mike, it would definitely be wrong. If he believes it's wrong, it would definitely be wrong for him to do that. For some of the others, might not be if you just went as a tourist place to go look at a historical. We went into the old Boston Church, where Paul Revere.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. We went in there and he sat down in the old wooden pews, but I didn't have anything spiritual in mind.
Yeah.
I did it, so
did that cost money? Because I don't think we went in. It could just be an issue of me being cheap. Okay.
We support non-Christian beliefs and idolatry on a fairly regular basis by the decisions we make. Sometimes it's completely unconscious. We don't think about it. When you go and you buy a vehicle or you purchase other things, where is that vehicle made? Who's profiting from the money that you spend? And although these things may not be directly linked, we may be supporting people who do not believe God and worship Him the way that we do, but we live in the world and we have to make the best decisions we can.
That's true. I guess the only thing I'm saying is, if you have a choice, why not exercise? And think about, we should think about the choices that we make, not just in this regard, but other regards too. And obviously, if we can support someone who's in the church versus someone who's not, that's a no-brainer. So,
Well, I think these are all good things for us to talk about. And I think that as we get, if we have opportunity to talk about church finance in detail, these may be things that come up again. All right, I want to kind of turn our attention back to the building and then ask what is, a question that is filled with landmines, I'm afraid. So if we understand that the church can own a building, then the next logical question is, what can the building be used for other than the assembly? And this becomes a very tricky question. I think there's two schools of thought on this, at least two that I can find. The first is, The building is just a meeting house, and it's not sacred, and therefore it really doesn't matter what else the building is used for. And, sort of the flip side of this is what Duane was saying is that, we can meet in the VFW hall, or we can meet in a school building, because at that time it's the assembly. What else it's used for doesn't affect the assembly. The second opinion on this is that the building, if it was purchased with church funds, was purchased with church funds and therefore ought to be used for the Lord's work. Now, I just want to comment on this, that I find it very interesting that the addition of a building, something that we don't see in the New Testament, so the addition of a building by us leads us by necessity to start making these other decisions that just make it murky. They just complicate things. And sometimes I wonder if we ought just to meet in people's homes. Because where do you draw the line? Would it be acceptable for us to have other religious groups meet in our building? Would we be okay with a wild frat party? I mean, it's just a building. Okay. Where do we draw the line? And
those things are extreme. I think all of us would say, oh, we wouldn't let a frat party happen. We wouldn't let it become a bingo hall or a gambling hall. But as we get closer to things that we're acceptable to, then that's where we start to have questions. There are those that think that it's not a good idea to have weddings in the building. And it's interesting to think about that. You know, if we say it's just a meeting house, well, would we allow a wedding in the meeting house? Well, clearly we have, because Emily and I got married here, and probably several of you got married in here too. If it's just a meeting house, we'll allow weddings in it. Well, what if the wedding is of two non-Christians? Would we let them use the building? What if it's a Christian who has no right to marry the person they're marrying? What if at the wedding they're going to be using musical instruments? These are all questions that just kind of murky the water, aren't they? My concern with the other position is that that we ought to use the building for the Lord's work only, is that it sure makes me feel like we're making the building sacred and a sanctuary. And so I'm not really sure where to fall on this issue, but in studying this, I was reminded of two passages that in a way, kind of make me smile as my mind boggles through this. In 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 23, Paul tells Timothy, "But avoid foolish and ignorant disputes, knowing they generate strife." And then he tells Titus the same thing in Titus 3 and 9, "But avoid foolish disputes, genealogies, contentions, and striving about the law, for they are unprofitable and useless." So I really don't want any responses, because I think it's just going to create turmoil. But it's one of those things, when you have a building, then you start having to make all of these other decisions about, well, is it appropriate to have this or not appropriate to have that? And, you know, it just makes things muddy. And so I guess we ought to avoid foolish disputes.
Decided in the past.
Absolutely. We have a building, and we as a congregation have decided that we're going to assemble, and our assembly is going to be in this location. There are lots of advantages to having a building, you know. Do any of us have a home large enough to support the congregation? Well, yes, we do. So we could meet in a home, but we're here publicly. There are advantages to it. We've made a decision to have a building. In making that decision to have a building, then you have to make decisions on what you are going to allow the building to be used for. And we have made those decisions. You know, we've said, well, you know, if people want to get married here, it's acceptable. And we have drawn some lines, but I'm just bringing it out that there's just some confusing things that the Bible just doesn't really give us clear answers on.
When you're talking about that, though, you know, the foolish part may not be that you discuss it. Because you have to discuss it, but the foolish part may be if you cannot come to an agreement, or if someone is led astray or goes astray because of the way the decision is reached, or the problem.
Yeah. The underlying issue, we're talking about logistics. We're not talking about the heart and attitude. But remember, our attitude must be one of love. And if Emily and I choose to, when we chose to get married, if we knew that Dwayne and Theta had an objection to having a wedding in the building, Emily and I ought to take that into consideration, because we shouldn't be putting Dwayne in a position where he has to choose between his friendship with us and his convictions. And so that may be the only comment that I'll make on this, is that we ought to be conscious of other people's beliefs.
These are some of the difficult
decisions
that leaders have to make, and I think I'm just going to say one thing. I think you have to use a lot of discretion.
Yeah.
And mercy with it.
And I'm choosing a topic of weddings to talk about because it's fairly benign. Because we know amongst our group, we don't all share the same beliefs about how the building should be used. We know that and specifically, I'm not trying to point anyone out, but specifically we know that there are those of our number who will have a meal in the building, and those that will not. And
And I hope that we'll have an opportunity to talk about that at some time, but we're not going to talk about it right now. All right, let's move on to Matthew chapter 18, since, you know, we're just stepping on landmine after another. Let's get to Matthew 18. This is a very interesting passage. In Matthew 18 and verse 20, we're told, "For where two or three are gathered together in my name, I am there in the midst of them." And oftentimes we see that this passage is referenced as a means to talk about the assembly, to imply in that where two or three Christians are gathered, it can be an assembly. And I think as we, outside of whether or not that is true, whether or not two or three Christians can gather and it be an assembly, I think we need to understand that this verse, Matthew 18 and 20, when we use it that way, we're not using it in context. So let's look at the context of this passage. In Matthew 17, verse 24 through 27, we find that Jesus is in Capernaum with his disciples. Now, on the way to Capernaum, the disciples have a dispute about who would be the greatest in the kingdom. That's Matthew chapter 18, verse 1. And then it is also recorded in Mark 9:33. And as an example, Jesus calls a little child to him to offer an explanation. That's Matthew 18 and 2, and then Mark 9 and 36. Now, it's not specified here in Matthew, but let's go back to Mark chapter 9, and in verse 35, we see that the people who are there are not all of the disciples, it's the apostles. And I think this becomes important. In Mark 9:35, it says, "And he sat down, called the 12, and said to them, 'If anyone desires to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all.'" And so here the setting is Jesus and his apostles, and what the apostles have been disputing about is who's going to be number one, right? When Jesus is gone, who's going to be the greatest? And so the instructions that follow in Matthew chapter 18 are about humility as opposed to rank, because they were concerned about rank. Jesus calls a little child to them, and he says, "You got to be humble like a child." Now, I knew if Paige was around, he wouldn't have called Paige up to talk to him, because Paige has the same problem the apostles have. Me first. But the idea being here is that we have to be humble like children. The same thing as we go on. It's better to be maimed and in heaven than full and in hell. And remember the stereotypes of those who were disabled at the time, that they were somehow second-class citizens. Even up until recently. Remember, FDR didn't ever want his picture taken in a wheelchair? Well, part of that was power, and part of it, he didn't want people to view him as weak, but part of it was the stigma associated with having a disability. And so there was this issue of, well, if you have some sort of physical infirmity, that you can't be a leader. The parable of the lost sheep. Although not entirely devoted to this idea of humility versus rank, I think we can see it in there, the idea of don't trample on the other sheep to become the top sheep, that if one of the sheep is gone, you better go find it, because everyone is important. And then the last is, instead of using the sin of your brother, this issue of discipline, which also becomes important, this issue of your brother sinning against you, instead of elevating yourself because, well, you know, he sinned, I'm going to use this against him, go and restore him. The idea here is that after all of this, Jesus reminds the apostles about their authority. He talks about the humility and talks about discipline, and then he reminds them that authority will be given to them. Matthew 18 and 18. "Assuredly I say to you, whether you bind on whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." The same thing is what he said earlier to Peter, and maybe the rest of the 12 in Matthew the 16th chapter. And then it's in this context of authority, that Jesus says in 19 and 20, "Again I say to you that if two of you agree on earth concerning anything that they ask, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. For whether two or three are gathered together in my name, I am there in the midst of them." The point that Jesus is trying to make here is that there isn't going to be one apostle over the others. There isn't going to be one apostle greater than the others. There's this issue that we see time and time again, two or three. Remember in discipline, discipline was a matter of two or three. If Mike sins against me, I'm first going to try to go to Mike and have it rectified. But if Mike won't listen to me, what am I supposed to do? Bring one or two with me. So now it's two or three. In the Old Testament, you weren't put to death unless by the witness of two or three. You're not supposed to bring an accusation against an elder except by the witness of two or three. But then there's also this issue of pairing, that the apostles were supposed to work together. Think about it. When Jesus sent the 70 out, what did he do? He sent them in pairs. When he sent the apostles out, he sent them in pairs. Paul always had Barnabas, and when he and Barnabas split up, both of them chose another man, Silas and then John Mark. So this passage, we like to say that, we sometimes say that it has to do with the assembly, but it isn't dealing with the assembly. It's not dealing with assembly or worship. It's dealing with authority and discipline. And even beyond that, I think that we've got a clear understanding that this passage deals with the apostles and not with Christians at large. Now, we get to the real underlying issue, and this is one of those touchy subjects that most often when this passage is cited, I think what we're finding is that it really is the question of, is a gathering of two or three Christians an assembly? And I think the answer to that question can be yes, but it also can be no. And I think part of it has to do with our motive. And let me explain to you why. This past fall, I normally go up to Brookfield to hunt, and I didn't get to go this year, and I'm sort of glad I didn't get to go for this one very reason. There was a group of Christians in the congregations that we associate with that the particular piece of property that my family hunts on. We usually hunt Saturday and then Sunday afternoon, and then Monday this other group comes in. Well, as my family went out Sunday morning to go hunt before services, they found that there were some other folks there, the folks that weren't supposed to be there till Monday. And so in conversations with them, well, they had partaken of, their comment was, well, we partook of the Lord's table before we left, just the four of us. And we see this happen sometimes with families too, that families will go on a vacation or be someplace and will partake of the Lord's table just as their family. And oftentimes this passage of Matthew 18 and 20 is used to justify that, that it's justification for a family or a small group partaking of the Lord's table outside of an established congregation, usually at vacations, but sometimes at other circumstances. And I just have to question our motives on this when we do this, because my concern is, where are our priorities when we do these things? Is our priority service to God, or is our priority our vacation, our own entertainment, the things that we like to do? And, Tad and Emily and I had talked about this some before. And, you know, we know that when the apostles went out, that they weren't at congregations that could partake of the Lord's. They weren't with congregations because they were establishing congregations. So it's very likely that Paul and Barnabas and the group that was with them, when it was the Lord's day, they, as a group, partook of the Lord's table. But I think that that's a completely different circumstance. And if we use that to support our decisions, you know, Paul and Barnabas and the apostles, they were doing the work of the Lord. When they had opportunity, they did stay so they could partake with the congregation. Look at what Paul did at Troas. He waited so that he could partake on the Lord's day. So I guess the question is motives. What's your motive in doing that? What's the most important thing in your life? Where's your priority? Is your priority entertaining yourself, doing the things that you want, or serving the Lord? Those were my comments on Matthew 18, and I thought that it'd give you an opportunity in the last couple of minutes if anybody had any other thoughts on this or on the idea of where Christians should assemble.